just a sec. I'm gonna move it back just a little bit so I don't fall off. There. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Desiree.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. I'm really honored and thrilled to be here. Thank you to the Journey to Serenity Festival event for hosting this and for the committee for putting this on. I know Richard from Winnipeg. He's a dear recovery friend of mine, and when he had mentioned a few months ago that this opportunity had come up, I was really excited. As it got closer and closer, I was like, oh, I didn't really think that through, and I was like, yeah! So this is actually the first time that I've shared my story within Al-Anon, and... Hi. Maybe I should stand down a little bit. You know what? I'm actually, if it's okay with you guys, I'm not going to stand on this step because otherwise I'm going to be maybe looking down too much. So, okay, let's try this. Is that okay? Can you hear me? Yeah? Good? Okay, perfect. I don't really remember that Karen's driving was really scary last night because all that's on my mind right now is that I walked on a bridge that a train was maybe going to come down. So that was a little bit of a surprise today. She had mentioned it last night, and when I woke up this morning in my hotel room, there was a picture of what I thought was probably that bridge, and I was like, that doesn't look that high, because she had asked me if I was afraid of heights yesterday, and to which I answered yes, and she was like, oh great, tomorrow we're gonna go to this bridge. So when we got there and we started walking up, and I was like, oh wow, like this is high. And then somebody mentioned, like, and there's trains that come down this, and I was like, oh my goodness, like, wow. And maybe it would have been okay, but that bridge, like, it was built with, like, nails. Like, I don't think they use nails anymore. Like, that is from, like, the gold rush or something. Like, whew, I was holding on really, really tight. So I will never remember the driving. I will just remember the bridge. But thank you. It was with a lot of grace that they brought me across. So I made it, and I'm here. So I'm going to get started. I do write things down. I will see if God brings me any other message that I want to talk about. But I do have things written down for us tonight. So I am going to start. Good evening. I'm Desiree, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Thank you for inviting me to share my experience, my strength, and my hope with you this evening. I'm excited and deeply honored to be here. I don't remember the first time that I heard the words aluminum, allspice, or Athens. And yet, I do remember the first time I heard the word Al-Anon. I was perhaps 7, maybe 8 years old, standing in my grandma's living room, eavesdropping on my grandma and my mom, when my mom said, my Auntie Lillian would be coming to visit after her Al-Anon meeting. I, ever fascinated with the comings and goings of the adult world, immediately asked, what's Al-Anon? To which my mom replied, it's where ladies go when their husbands drink too much. The fact that I remember this is remarkable in itself given my age and the relative insignificance of this exchange. But what truly fascinates me today is that I still remember viscerally the feeling that I had about this response. I was confused, almost angry. Why would my aunt have to go somewhere for his problem? Shouldn't he be going somewhere instead? Little did I know, some 30 years later, the answers to these questions would become abundantly clear as I too found strength, serenity, and hope within this beautiful program. I first came to Al-Anon while I was fortunate enough to be dating an alcoholic. He had been in AA for many years, and I wanted what I could see he already had, an unshakable sense of peace with what is, a powerful faith in the loving kindness of God, a sense of security in his safety, and his well-being. At the time, I had the opposite of these. I was terror-stricken and panicked, unsure God was always on my side and devoid of faith in my future happiness. And I couldn't figure out why, as hard as I tried. The thing is, from the outside, my life and childhood were pretty charmed. Yet, unbeknownst to me, the ghost of alcoholism had been lurking in the shadows all along and had created devastating and confusing consequences. One of my parents had been raised in a family of hard and problem drinkers, and the fact that they too lived within the grips of insecurity, fear, and resentment that alcoholism both produces and falsely claims to eliminate is to be expected. And I have now learned that, of course, I would acquire some of these things myself. That is the nature of this disease. When I look back, I can see clearly that alcohol, liquor, booze, and a subsequent affection and affliction that surround this mysterious and seductive libation has been present for as long as I can remember. In fact, my earliest memories take place in the dampness of a dark and smoky beverage room under the sprawling skies of the Manitoba prairies. The bar to the country hotel my parents bought when I was just 2 years old became one of my daycares. The patrons, some of my favorite playmates, as I mingled around during the afternoons while my parents worked. There were all the usual suspects of such an establishment at that hour. Hard drinkers at best, more likely active alcoholics. Val, the over-tobaccoed fixture at one of the back tables, slowly instructing another playing of J26 as she slid sticky dimes across the table for me to put in the jukebox. Gus, the friendly old farmer, with a kind smile, happily sipping his third rye and water at 4 p.m. Or Jake, the quick-to-laugh, rowdy, and mulleted ladies' man, sporting a Molson Canadian t-shirt beneath his one-piece skidoo suit. Oh, yeah. These afternoons were fun for me. Amidst the clank of returning empties, I would happily play with my Barbies on the floor, a highball glass of Orange Crush at my side. And when the night would take its more sinister turn, as it's apt to in a room full of such characters lubricated with 4 hours of doubles, I would be quickly ushered upstairs to the care of a babysitter, the muffled sounds of tonight's feature act lulling me to sleep with 80s hair band abandon. A few years later, after we moved thousands of miles away to an environment more suitable for a child, alcohol and drinking was absent. I remember these as calm and peaceful years, and likely the most stable of my childhood. But I now know that the effects of alcoholism, although perhaps dormant at the time, were present and able to resurface when life would take a more challenging turn. When we moved back to Manitoba, when I was approaching my teens, disease with life, insecurity, and pain resurfaced in my family, and my home life became littered with the confusing paradoxes and instability common in the experiences of a child of the family disease of alcoholism, as love and laughter were freely provided one moment and abruptly taken away the next. I took on the defense mechanisms that seem apt when hurt and scared, lonely and confused. I threw mind-numbing tantrums, sulked and stalked around, whined and cried. I kept to myself or pleaded for attention, rebelled and complied, instructed and manipulated. None of these worked as the unconditional and consistent acceptance that I craved from someone without the tools to provide it continued its elusive disappearing act. I grew to further mistrust the world, and although I fully believed God was out there, I didn't really trust him either. He also seemed inconsistent and unreliable. The hurt I felt continued to bury my heart further and further under the sands of loneliness and shame. I became practiced in the art of self-loathing, fully convinced there was something alarmingly wrong with me, and that most everything, from the sadness and silence of others to the bad thoughts and feelings I had, was my fault. I was also starting to get annoyed that the adults in my life could not always be relied upon to be adulty.
They seemed carefree at inopportune times, unaffected or unaware of things that I thought matter. I quickly took on the role of informer, protector, and evaluator, always with a bit of advice here, a warning there. It felt so ridiculous to me that I, just a kid, could see that they were doing things that were sure to produce unappealing results. Perhaps we should get gas before it runs out, I would ask, or something to this effect. I was often angry at them for letting me down, for refusing to act responsibly, and for letting me take on the role of adult while they got to be the happy-go-lucky or sulking children. But they never told me to stop. They seemed okay with me being a mini adult. In fact, it was often a point of praise that I was so mature. It seemed like this was a natural fit for me, to be in charge. And it also seemed like this must be what love is, to tell others what to do when they don't know what to do themselves. As I got older, the controlling reminders and bad attitude were chalked up to classic teen malaise. Hormones or the sad music of the mid-90s assumed to be the cause. I didn't know why I was so mad or bossy or lonely, but like everyone else, I figured that once the new millennium started and I grew out of whatever the hell was going on, the sun would come out and life would be fine. But as you know, that's not what happened. I didn't grow out of anything, or I wouldn't be here today. Naturally, I continued this cycle of control throughout the rest of my life. As it often happens, sometimes I flipped the script and took on the role of child with people who were all too happy to take on the role of adult themselves. For a time, I would enjoy this because finally it felt like someone was taking care of me and making the adult decisions. I got to be the child I always wanted to be, while they got to remind me to be responsible. I would relax because they did all the worrying and advising for me. Of course, this would fail the moment I decided to act against their instructions. Then I would decide in defiance and defense, I am not going to be controlled again. And I'd go back to being the controller. Back and forth, over and over again. Both of these roles became familiar, and before Al-Anon, it seemed like they were the only options, controller or controlee. As unhappiness, loneliness, and an insatiable urge to find love and stability in all the wrong places propelled drama and destruction, I became even more fearful, mean, manipulative, angry, and resentful. Although my professional life appeared intact, my personal life was a disaster. My relationships with family and friends were painful and problematic, but I didn't even pay attention to that. It was my romantic life that took up all my time and energy, as I sought approval and consistency by whatever means possible, with guys flaunting fluorescent warning labels indicating their emotional unavailability. I worked desperately to be loved, to be loving, to feel love, but it didn't work, and I wanted better. I think I even knew I deserved better, that somewhere the happy and sweet girl that I really was there, but I couldn't find her. I didn't know where I was, who I was supposed to be, or who I even wanted to be, but I did know one thing for certain. I didn't like, love, or approve of the person I was. And so, about 5 years ago, I began the Desiree Fix-It Project. I was determined to repair myself for good. I took on this pursuit with the same passion, intellectualization, and control that I had exhibited in the rest of my life, seeking some semblance of stability once and for all. I listened to audiobook after audiobook of self-improvement cures. I burned notes of things I didn't want and posted notes of things I did. I drank only filtered water and took blistering cold showers. I tried everything they say will increase self-esteem and decrease self-loathing. And I single-handedly created the perfect little stable bubble for myself. And it worked. I was happy and content. I was cured. And perhaps I could have continued to fool myself if I had stayed alone. But that wasn't God's plan. And instead, my supposed nirvana of tranquility that I had finally achieved was challenged when I attempted to try Desiree 2.0 out in a new romantic relationship. At the time, I had no idea that the real change and stability I craved for so long was right around the corner, nor the pain I would endure and inflict to get there. I thought I had fixed myself and that I was ready for a real relationship, this time with a nice guy who I had stuff in common with. He was really sweet, like see someone trip in Walmart and rush over to aid them sweet. And funny and smart, I just knew this time it's going to be different. I'm different. And this time it was different because I was unhappy even though he was nice to me. I was suspicious even though he was trustworthy. I was angry even though he had done nothing wrong. I was all those nasty, awful things that had plagued me for years in spite of all the work I had done to fix myself. And this guy, did he fight back during my raging accusatory tantrums or ice-cold silent treatments? Nope. He just sat there, kind and supportive, patiently waiting for me to finish so he could remind me that he cared about me and that even though I was behaving like this, it wasn't who I really was. Who was this guy? How could he be so calm? He never shouted at me. He never demeaned me. He never wavered in his kindness and patience. And with a profound display of the power of attraction rather than promotion, he showed me what it can be like to exist within the supreme care of a higher power. How a heart can be open and still be safe. How security and serenity are possible, even though life is unpredictable and not always as we want it to be. And he quietly suggested the option of Al-Anon, casually mentioning that since he was an alcoholic, I could go, careful not to touch the scar of pain of growing up with alcoholism, knowing full well that I had neatly packed that reality away years before, unaware or unable to face the truth of what this had meant for me. And so, on February 21st, 2018, the day after the most excruciating tantrum I had ever thrown, when words I didn't even know I knew spewed from my gut with such fury and hot speed that I surprised even myself, I walked into my first meeting and began my journey within the program of Al-Anon. Solution is defined by Oxford English Dictionary as a means of solving a problem or dealing with a difficult situation. In Al-Anon, I found just that, a means of solving a problem, me, and dealing with a difficult situation, my life. I found a solution. My analytical and curious mindset is well suited to the systematic and precise recommendations I discovered in Al-Anon. There are steps and books, meetings and slogans, a whole spiritual kit, if you will. I am comforted with the clear instructions and like knowing what to do to get me where I want to go. And the fact that a result, a spiritual awakening, was written into step 12 was a pretty good motivator to me to get started. At first, I'll admit, it did sound too good to be true. And too simple to work. How could writing stuff down, telling someone my secrets, and silently reciting words in my own head to the dean of the world possibly fix my life? But I had nothing to lose. The writing was on the wall, and I could see plainly that what I was doing was not working. And the genuine smiles and serenity that I felt radiating from long-term members was evident enough that it was worth at least a try. One of the first tools I was able to grasp was the concept of loving detachment. At my second meeting, I heard a member share that I could leave people to their own devices and still love them. That not meddling in their lives didn't need to be a passive-aggressive way of still trying to harness control, but instead a loving way of respecting their God-given boundaries and my own right to a peaceful existence. Understanding that I could let others do as they see fit without judgment or disdain and give them the dignity of making their own decisions and experiencing the outcomes, good or bad, was freeing for me and I'm sure appreciated by them. Next, I learned that having expectations of anyone or anything was a common recipe for disappointment. This made complete sense to me, as I could see how much of my life had been based on what I wanted others to do, how I wanted others to be, and that their failure to live up to my wishes and hopes had always left me with a deflated feeling of self-pity and resentment. Through these small understandings, step one started to become clearer and clearer. I had admitted that my life was unmanageable the day I had stepped through the door. That part was obvious to me, or I would have never come. And admitting that I was powerless over anything, especially alcohol, became easier as I saw the benefits of loving detachment and no expectations take root. Previously, I had had so much evidence of being able to control or be controlled that I thought power was a human right. I didn't know that this was a false and disastrous illusion. Now I can see that I was lucky to have my character asset of a deep appreciation for efficiency by my side at this time. Once I found out that no matter what, I'm not going to get anything from trying to control alcohol or others, that this ability or authority is not mine, was never mine, and will never in the future ever be mine, it just seemed like a waste of time and energy to even try. Step two really just required a reworking of my concept of God. I had always believed in a higher power, and even though I thought he was pretty nice, thanks to my grandma telling me he was, I also had this concept of him that he was like a busy dean of an Ivy League university that I would have to wait months to get a meeting with, and even then it might be rushed or he might be a bit distracted. I didn't know that he was ready and willing to meet with me anytime I wanted, and that in fact, he had been waiting for me patiently for years. I soon discovered that if I kept my appointments with him, he could restore me to sanity with compassion and kindness. And as I saw the principles of this program already making changes in my feelings and in my life, it felt obvious that this was what was happening. He was restoring me to sanity. And for the first time, I didn't ask how this was happening. In fact, I think I forgot to ask or even wonder. It just seemed to feel right, which I now see was God, because previously I needed to know why or how or what for everything. As things started to change, I kept coming to meetings because you told me to and because they feel good. Here I found a genuine acceptance of who I was by people who didn't seem to care about all the mean and nasty capabilities I had. They seemed to be happy to see me anyway. I remember how soothing the part of our closing was when I first heard it, that perhaps we might not like each other, but one day we may love each other in our own special way. This was one of the first experiences I had ever had with the idea of unconditional acceptance and love even if we don't like something. At my sixth meeting, I asked my lovely sponsor if she would work with me, and she said yes. She's here, which is awesome. I had known she was who I would like to ask the moment I met her at my second meeting. I could feel intuitively that God had designed it so I would sit next to her and feel her calm and accepting energy. I could tell she would be someone I would feel comfortable sharing and growing with. Through sponsorship, I got another tool for the spiritual kit, a way to access what God would have me know through the wisdom and channeling of another. By discussing my challenges and obstacles with someone who has gone through this journey before me, I hear different perspectives, learn ways that worked for them, and have a general sense that I am not alone, weird, or broken. Through sponsorship, I have also become well-versed in the practice of always go to God first. At first, I wanted concrete answers from my sponsor. I wanted to know, what exactly should I do about X, Y, and Z? However, I often got the question, did you go to God? And through this, I received something so much more profound. Rather than a solution to a single problem, I was encouraged to practice the building of my own bridge to my own higher power, a bridge that I started to learn I could access anytime I needed and find the wisdom and serenity of His will. I remember the first time I saw this in all its glory while I was at a bachelorette weekend in Banff with 12 girls, and some little thing bothered me, and I just thought, what would my sponsor say? And I knew she would ask me, did I go to God? And so I did, and what do you know, I felt better. Although I was already having powerful and transformative changes by this time, step three would have something else in store for me. Things had gone really well so far, and there was no doubt in my mind that God was working. But turn the whole kit and caboodle over, that was a bit much. I felt like I was the aging director of a large corporation with failing share prices. I knew I had to step down, but I had built this thing from the bottom. And was the guy next in line really qualified? He had been doing a good job on the executive council, but what if he didn't care about the company like I did? What if he didn't know what to do? What if he got distracted or didn't take the ownership required to make it succeed? And here I stayed, refusing to sign my resignation papers until I completed just one last project, maybe did a few final hires. And what about that Atlantic deal? I should probably get that sorted out first. That is when a wise recovery friend, Richard, reminded me of the actual words to this step. Made a decision. It turned out that all I needed to do was make the decision that this resignation was going to happen, and that the other nine steps would carefully and compassionately lead me to a place where signing it all over would be the natural thing to do, where I would feel so much trust and faith in the power of the one next in line that turning my will over would feel like the best possible option. Okay. I can do that. So I made the decision. When it's time, I will step down. I will turn my will over to the care of my higher power as I understand it when it feels right. So decision made. Next is step four. I had spent the last 25 years of my life listing every bad thing I had ever done in my head repeatedly, so I figured I had this memorized and it would be easy. I quickly learned how riddled with denial I was when I lied through a page and a half on the topic of honesty in our Blueprint to Change workbook. believed what I had been told, that thoroughness was a required element to this program, I halted immediately and waited and prayed for some sort of insight or intuitive direction. A few weeks later, it was suggested I try step 4 using a resentments, fears, harms method, and I gave it a try. I listed my resentments, then I listed what all those sons of a bitches did to me. And when I got to the where am I to blame column, I had a palatable awakening. The first resentment was long festering, and I had spent oodles of hours and thousands of dollars in therapy discussing it from every angle. I was sure I understood this thing left, right, and center. And I was even more sure it was all their fault. But as I began to write, a realization of where I actually was to blame flashed before me. A blind spot was revealed that shone the entire situation in a completely different light than I had recited in my mind for years. My ego had been at play in this resentment. I had stepped on the toes of my fellow man. They had naturally retaliated. As I went through the where am I to blame column for each resentment, I began to break free. No longer did I need to wallow in self-pity for all the injustices I had suffered, because it turns out that I had, if not always set the ball rolling, at least kept it rolling. This is when I started to really feel the reins of my will peacefully slip from my hands. Something had brought me these insights, and something was helping me feel such a profound sense of peace with things that used to cause me so much pain. It had to be a power greater than myself, because I had tried to make sense of all of these things for years. Maybe he was qualified to take on the whole job. Maybe he really did know what he was doing. Maybe he was better at this job than I. This was more evident when I went through step 5. Again, I knew thoroughness was required, and that this would only work if I was honest and told the truth, as I knew it and felt it. So I did. I said things I had never said to another human being. I said things I had never admitted to myself. And I said things that I knew God knew but would appreciate me acknowledging. I shined a flashlight on the nooks and crannies in the basement of my being that I had tried to ignore for years. And it turned out that it wasn't so scary. Saying out loud what I had hidden from released the spell of fear that I was rotten or evil or defective. I was not wearing a yellow dress when I left my step 5. Nor did I sing out loud or skip down the street, and there certainly were not cartoon birds fluttering around me. But in my memory of that day, that is what happened. The immense weight that had been lifted was undeniable. I felt lighter, freer, and more peaceful than I could ever remember. By now, I was convinced that God wanted me to be free from shame and guilt, and from fear, and he would do his part if I did mine. If I was honest, well-meaning, and intentional in working this program and practicing the principles to the best of my ability at the time, I would feel nuggets of goodness and calm and tranquility. Step 6 was relaxing because it felt like a time of pause, an opportunity to review where I had been and decide if I wanted to go back to life before Al-Anon or continue on this journey. To decide if I was willing to let go of the armor that had once kept me safe but was now just weighing me down. Was I ready to release the defects of character that had been obstacles to my happiness and fulfillment? I recognized that anything other than a willingness to let go of these would just return my life back to the unmanageability I had fruitlessly tried to rectify for years. I didn't want to go back. Therefore, there was no way other than forward. Willingness became easy when I weighed the alternatives, my old life versus my new experiences. And thus I arrived at step 7. This was the step that I had naively really been looking forward to when I first started. The spiritual awakening of step 12 was great and all, but step 7 had sounded like the one that would get me what I really wanted. All the bad things were moved, so I just wouldn't have to be a jerk or sad, and I could just be perfect, and everyone would love me. Well, as we all know, the steps are in order for a reason. And when I finally got to step 7, I understood that getting everyone to love me or being perfect was not the point. So instead of bargaining or trading with God, telling him which shortcomings should go first, which things were causing me the most inconvenience, and generally telling him how to do his job, I decided to try on this word humbly. Before Al-Anon, I had thought humility was kind of for quiet people who didn't really expect much from life and therefore didn't get much. Instead, I learned that humbly means I don't know the answers. I don't know the overarching plan for my life or my recovery. And instead, I can just let him to decide what to remove, if anything, when he so pleases. And once again, I forgot to ask how this would work, if it would work, or when it would work. I just seemed to trust that it would work when and if he wanted it to. And naturally, without pain or struggle, I started making different decisions, taking better actions, and feeling more at ease with myself and the world. I seemed to stop needing to be right all the time, losing the compulsion to have what I thought affirmed by others. I forgot to compare myself, understanding that we are all unique creations. I started to let him make the decisions, knowing his way was better and easier anyway. This is also when the slogan "Progress, not perfection" became a lifeline. Previously, perfection had been my only option, and if unattained, I would usually become paralyzed and unable to move forward. Instead, I knew I needed to remember that I'm still human, I am only on step 7, and that recovery is a daily practice of progressive results. Through this simple phrase, I was able to remember that mistakes are okay, and that even when I make them, God loves me anyway. This gave me an enormous sense of peace as I was beginning to understand that if God loves me unconditionally, I might just be able to love me unconditionally too. As I prepared and reviewed my list of people I had harmed in step 8, I took another pause to assess the terrain and determine if I was willing to do what was necessary to continue forward on my path. I was keenly aware that thoroughness and fearlessness had been essential in the previous steps, so I knew that these were necessary tools to take along. Could I employ them again, honestly and fully? Was I ready to focus solely on my part in each and every situation? I knew by now that God was at my side, so there was nothing to fear, that no matter what, he wasn't going anywhere. And so naturally, with peace and comfort, I came to the point where I felt willing to continue to do my part. Step nine began with the amends that I was most scared to make. I felt that rather than letting this one loom ahead of me, I might as well face it head on and get my side of that street cleared off. I knew that I needed to be thorough and polite, yet not scraping and servile. So I took time to meditate and to ensure every piece of my part would be accounted for, no more or no less. I was cautious to ensure that I had clearly identified the truth and the scope of my part. As a face-to-face meeting was not possible, I made arrangements for a phone call. In preparation, I set up a little cocoon of care on my couch, complete with photos of loved ones, special mementos, candles, and warm blankets. I wanted to have reminders of the love of God at the ready, in case I got scared. When the phone rang at the arranged upon time, I took a breath and said hello. The feeling after I hung up was nothing like I had felt before. God had stayed at my side, and with him, I was able to face what I had to say with an immense sense of courage. My voice didn't shake. I did not waver in admitting difficult truths, and I wasn't left with a sick feeling of shame or guilt after. I had done my part to clean up my side of the street, and I felt peace radiating through my body. Making amends continues to be one of the most rewarding experiences of this program to me. I make mistakes, and I harm people, but I'm learning that I do those things because I am human, and that they come from a place of naive self-will and fear. As long as I am willing to face them, repair and let go of the attitude or action that caused them, and take accountability for my part, I need not carry around guilt or shame for the rest of my life. And next is step 10, divinely positioned directly after step 9 so that I can continue to spot challenges in perpetuity and deal with them promptly so that pain and problems don't fester and worsen. In fact, as I practice this step in my daily life, I am becoming more able to pause when agitated and perhaps limit or even prevent a step on the toes of my fellow man. I'm enjoying avoiding messes before they happen or cleaning up immediately after, and credit this step with reminding me of the defense mechanisms I do not need to use anymore, so the kind and loving person I am can naturally rise to the surface. Through daily dialogue with my higher power in step 11, I receive insight into what my higher power would have me do and faith that this is designed for my ultimate well-being. As I practice consciously connecting with my higher power, I am discovering all kinds of iterations of divine entities that I feel comfortable receiving guidance, protection, and unconditional love and acceptance from. I am thankful for their presence in my life and find that all it takes is a conscious and intentional millisecond to reconnect if connection has been dropped. I am very comfortable with the concept of a God of my ununderstanding. I do not ask what God is, where it is, or what it is. I know that seeking these answers would be a fruitless path for me, and that not understanding does not preclude my ability to enjoy the benefits of this experience. I do not know how internet gets into my computer, but it does, and I accept that, so I will accept this too. And now, step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. By the time I reached step 12, the personality change that I had undergone was undeniable, and I could feel a power greater than myself operating in my life. After careful consideration and discussion with my sponsor, I started to work with my first sponsee. At first, part of me was a bit bittersweet about this. I had had such a rewarding experience in the first 11 steps that I was reluctant to be done. At the time, I did not realize that carrying the message creates a new chapter of recovery that not only maintains but amplifies the serenity and comfort initially discovered. Sharing the gifts and tools that were given to me from my sponsor allows me to experience and integrate them again and again, reconfirming their validity and continuing their presence in my life. As I continue to seek to practice the principles of this program in my life, when I remember to go to God, when I respond rather than react, when I attempt progress, not perfection, I see even more evidence of how much easier, more fun, and more pleasant life is. This evidence inspires me to stick with it, to seek His will rather than mine, and to rest in faith that this works. I have heard that Michelangelo said that God had already created the David, and that it was just his job to clear away all the unneeded marble to reveal it.
I've never been able to cry out of happiness. Like, in my life, I was so afraid to cry because it would be very sad. It's a really rewarding experience to be able to feel emotions and tears without being devastated, and instead, no, it's, I think this is the opening of the heart, guys. I think it's happening right in front of us. I have heard that Michelangelo said that God had already created the David, and that it was just his job to clear away all the unneeded marble to reveal it. I feel that this is what happens in Al-Anon, that the person I really am is always there. But unneeded dirt and debris needs to be carefully removed to allow my light to shine and my heart to be free. I didn't know what to expect when I started Al-Anon. Yet, the awakening that I have access to is unlike anything that I could have ever imagined. I've heard it remarked that if we got what we wanted when we first started recovery, we would have sold ourselves short. When I started, I just wanted the bad things to go away. I had no idea that instead, I would be granted something so much more. A higher power to stand by my side when the bad things happen. And that with this remarkable and renewable assurance that I will be okay, no matter what. I just have one sentence left. And that with this remarkable and renewable assurance that I will be okay no matter what, I would be granted the keys to open my heart and just be me. Thank you.
Thank you, Desiree. On behalf of everyone here, I really appreciate you sharing your experience, strength, and hope. And I am so grateful I got to see a piece of you I never got to see before. So on behalf of the committee and everybody here, I'd like to present you with a thank you gift. And a bunch of tissue paper.